content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello and welcome to the March 2015 edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? A program from the Triangle Radio Reading Service in cooperation with the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. I'm George Douglas. This program is all about books, with special emphasis on those available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Now, the library has more than 86,000 titles in its collection. Books and magazines are available in large print, braille, and talking books as well, both digital and a few cassettes still available. The library has more than 11,000 patrons across the state, and if you're not one of them but are interested in becoming a patron, I'll have more information for you how you can do that at the end of this program. Now, this month, we will take a look at some of the most popular books checked out during the months of January and February 2015 at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Our first book to take a look at today is a popular author. It's The Escape by David Baldacci, and I'll be reading a review by Ray Palin that was done in November. David Baldacci was poised to directly hit the top of the bestseller list with his latest effort, The Escape, the third installment in his series featuring military investigator John Puller, who was also seen in Zero Day and The Forgotten. While Baldacci has become a quite prolific writer, publishing at least three books a year for the past several years, there's been no let-up in his writing style. Other authors who release with the same or better frequency often have their work diluted, but not so with Baldacci, whose writing remains as intense and intricately plotted with each successive effort. What The Escape does is depict real-world situations steeped in deep government secrecy that will make you believe Baldacci has a direct line to the inner sanctum of the U.S. government. The thrills, no matter how fantastic, are extremely and scarily plausible, and the result is a novel that reads like a summer beach thriller. A year ago, no one in the U.S. probably worried about Ebola, yet The Escape has a potential Ebola attack on the nation's capital at the apex of the many chilling plot twists included within. The novel opens with the escape of the book's title, which involves Robert Puller, the older brother of our protagonist Robert, has been imprisoned in the United States disciplinary barracks that sits next to Leavenworth in the center of the nation. He is there for allegedly selling government secrets to our enemies and breaching national security. Prior to his incarceration, he was in line to take a leadership position within a branch of the U.S. intelligence community. Puller is tasked by the U.S. government and some extremely powerful intelligence and military leaders to bring his brother in. The inexplicable escape from what was supposedly an impenetrable prison proves that Robert is not to be taken lightly and may very well be working with others, possibly enemies of the United States. Puller himself is assigned a partner in this initiative, an agent named Veronica Knox, who may have an agenda of her own. Baldacci deftly keeps readers in suspense as to where Knox's true allegiance lies throughout the entire novel. Robert gets in contact with Puller, swearing his innocence. It seems that some dangerous and traitorous individuals within the U.S. government wanted to keep Robert from taking control in his new position. Now, this also involves the possible partnership with one of our Cold War enemies who has once again emerged as a threat to the West. The plot moves forward at a fast pace with surprises around nearly every corner. Baldacci has the writing skill to rely on the interpersonal relationships of his characters to drive things forward rather than utilizing technology or other tools to solve problems. The Escape is a vital and relevant thriller that will call to mind both the Edward Snowden case and the risk our nation faces every day with WMDs that could be used against us at a moment's notice. Hold your breath and enjoy the ride. That was The Escape by David Baldacci, one of the most popular books at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped this past month. In just a few minutes on this program, we're going to review John Grisham's Gray Mountain, which was a great book, so stay tuned for that. But right now, we're going to take a look at a book called Cut and Thrust by Stuart Woods. And this is a review from last summer by Barbara Gershenbaum. Cut and Thrust is Stuart Woods' 30th Stone Barrington novel. In this latest suspense offering, Stone and a powerful group of his friends are on their way to Los Angeles for the Democratic National Convention. First is the President of the United States, William Jefferson Lee, and First Lady Catherine Rule Lee, also a candidate for the upcoming election. Next is Ann Keaton, Catherine's deputy campaign manager, who is also acknowledged as Stone's girlfriend. As the plans continue to move along, more people are added to the growing list of passengers who will be aboard Stone's plane. Every one of Stone's traveling companions is given shelter at his glorious hotel in Los Angeles's upper echelon of hotels. Once they gather themselves and move onto the convention floor, they're amazed to see how much chaos is afoot. They quickly become aware of the bargaining and backroom deals being made among and for the delegates. Stone uses his sixth sense when it comes to assessing and judging the motives of people. And he just doesn't feel comfortable with Special Agent Mervyn Beam of the Secret Service, who is in charge of the L.A. office. Now, the two men meet privately when Beam requested this powwow. Stone is handed an email that threatens Kate's life. As a former New York policeman, Stone's radar is instantly on high mode. But as things come to pass, this episode will take readers on a twist in the narrative they never expected. Now, after they land and things calm down a bit, Stone is contacted by his son, Peter, who lives in Brentwood. He and a friend have purchased parcels of adjoining land in order to build two houses for themselves and their significant others. Dinner party rules and invitations are exchanged, and a pleasant evening is had by all. The next day, Stone visits the property and is roundly impressed. Later, as the entourage is getting ready for the gala at the convention center, Agent Beam brings Stone a complaint. Kate changed the seating plan, and he is clearly against where she wants people to sit. When Stone tells Anne, she says that Beam is probably just nervous because of the high stakes of his responsibility, but that is not good enough for Stone. One of the friends who is part of the group is Ed Eagle. He is close to Stone and not embarrassed to tell him that his ex-wife Barbara is on the prowl for him. She wants him dead. A series of cloak-and-dagger attempts at his life are foiled, and Barbara turns the whole situation around to where she has gotten the press to believe that it is Ed who is after her. Of course, he fights back, but damage control is difficult to maintain. The convention continues in the mode that these things do, with bargaining and secrets pushing the characters along with the action. Fans and readers new to Stuart Woods will not be disappointed by this masterfully crafted political thriller. Again, that was a review by Barbara Gershenbaum. It was done last summer. The book is called Cut and Thrust by Stuart Woods. Tammy Hoag is a popular author among the patrons of the North Carolina Library for the Blind, and this month there are three books by this author that are actually on the top 10 list. That's for January and February. The first one is called Night Sins, and it's part of the Deer Lake series. Here's a summary. A peaceful Minnesota town where crime is something that just doesn't happen, is about to face its worst nightmare. A young boy disappears. There are no witnesses, no clues, only a note, cleverly taunting, casually cruel. Has a cold-blooded kidnapper struck, or is this the reawakening of a long, quiet, serial killer. A tough-minded investigator on her first make-or-break case, a local cop who fears that big city evils have come to stalk his small town home. Together, they're hunting for a madman who knows no bounds to protect a town that they may never feel safe in again. That's Night's Ends by Tammy Hoag, part of the Deer Lake series. Now, here's a second book that was in the top 10 this past month, also by Tammy Hoag. It's called Still Waters. The deepest waters hide the darkest secrets. When the body of a murdered man literally falls at Elizabeth Stewart's feet, she's able to wash away the blood, but not the terror. Unwelcome newcomers to Still Creek, Minnesota, she and her troubled teenage son are treated with suspicion by the locals, including the sheriff. Yet nothing will stop her from digging beneath the town's placid surface for the truth, except the killer. Running from a messy divorce, Elizabeth believed buying a small-town newspaper offered a fresh start for herself and her son. But idyllic Still Creek, nestled in the heart of lush Amish farmlands, hides secrets dangerous enough to push someone to commit murder. Now Elizabeth must risk everything to save herself and her son and to unmask the killer before the current of evil flowing through Still Creek drags her under. When Elizabeth Stewart searched for a quiet, peaceful home for herself and her son, Still Creek seemed perfect. Nestled in the heart of lush Amish farmlands, this idyllic Minnesota town would allow her to put a shattering divorce behind her. But the locals were noticeably cool to the newcomer, who was rumored to be a gold digger, especially when she started stirring up controversy with her newspaper. And now, when a murdered body literally falls at her feet, she has a slight credibility problem, particularly with the arrogant sheriff, whose blue eyes seem to know her darkest secrets. An ex-pro athlete who had returned to Still Creek, a hero, Sheriff Dane Jansen, doesn't have much use for the media, especially not in the form of this glamorous, gutsy outsider who spells trouble with every word she prints. So when she becomes his suspect in a vicious crime, the last thing Dane expects is the jolt of attraction at every encounter. Elizabeth would soon challenge Dane's every assumption, including the one that he's better off without love. But as they risk everything to uncover the truth, the current of evil that contaminates Still Creek threatens to pull them both under. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? That's called Still Waters by Tammy Hoag. And yet a third book this month that was very popular at the North Carolina Library for the Blind by Tammy Hoag also. It is called Guilty as Sin. Again, it takes place, as most of her books do, in Minnesota. A cold-blooded kidnapper has been playing a twisted game with a terrified Minnesota town. Now, a respected member of the community stands accused of a horrific act of evil. But when a second boy disappears, a frightened public demands to know, have the police caught the wrong man? Is the nightmare continuing, or is it just beginning? Prosecutor Ellen North believes she's building a case against a guilty man and that he has an accomplice in the shadows. As she prepares for the trial of her career, Ellen suddenly finds herself swept into a cruel contest of twisted wits, a dark dance of life and death, with an evil mind as guilty as sin. And that is the name of the book by Tammy Hoag. One of three books this month that Tammy Hoag wrote that are extremely popular at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. And you're listening to Heard Any Good Books Lately here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks for joining me today. As I promised you, we have a book by John Grisham coming up. This is his latest book. It's a good one called Gray Mountain by John Grisham. And this is a review that was done just a couple of months ago, shortly after the book came out. It was done by Stuart Schiffman. Law is truly our national pastime, says the reviewer. The fascination Americans have with all things legal knows no limits. Regularly, the country fixates on a courtroom where the current trial of the century is underway. Between law and order, numerous lawyers masquerading as judges on television, and the gavel-to-gavel coverage of crime and trials, we are clearly a nation obsessed with the law. But surprisingly, the lawyers, the building blocks of that legal system, are generally held in low regard. Politicians rail against villains and tassel loafers, and lawyer jokes still remain a popular item in many email inboxes. Our love of the legal system is embodied in the works of John Grisham. His name seems permanently inscribed on the bestseller list, and his fans eagerly anticipate each of his new novels. While Grisham loves the law, he is not reluctant to criticize what he believes are the shortcomings of American lawyers. His recent works of fiction have begun focusing on contemporary legal issues that he believes need attention. It may be the death penalty, the abuses of the tort system, or financial abuses in judicial campaigns, but if Grisham has strong feelings about a subject, he will use it as the basis for a novel. Now, Gray Mountain is an entertaining and informative novel that exposes readers to two worlds of the law. The first is where wealthy individuals or businesses can have all the legal services that money can buy, so long as they are willing to spend several hundred dollars an hour. On the other side of the legal service equation are the poor, who have equally important legal difficulties but cannot afford adequate legal representation. Presenting the dilemma of inadequate legal services in the country with more lawyers than the rest of the world, Grisham has chosen a heroine as the vehicle for discussing this contemporary problem of American law. Samantha Cofer has an outstanding legal pedigree. Her mother is a career Justice Department attorney, while her father once was a preeminent plaintiff's attorney. That was until some legal shenanigans cost him his license and sent him to federal prison for a short stretch. As Gray Mountain opens, it is the financial crisis of 2008. Samantha's promising career in her Wall Street commercial firm, and it's a real estate law firm, has been torn asunder as the company hemorrhages clients, money, and lawyers. Although Samantha loses her job, she is offered the opportunity to retain her health insurance if she serves as an unpaid intern in a legal clinic. Now, she moves to Brady, Virginia, in rural Appalachia, with a population of 2,200. It is this perfect juxtaposition between wealth and poverty in America's legal system that sets the parameters for Samantha's work. Samantha finds herself in coal country, where the coal workers of the nation are fighting an uphill battle against an industry that is focused only on profits. Miners are simply the means to make money, and black lung disease, injuries on the job, and the environment all take a backseat to the almighty dollar. The coal industry has their own well-paid lawyers who have no hesitation to spend more on litigation than it would cost to simply settle a case. Samantha, along with some courageous allies, battles the coal industry, but it is a war in which time and resources are all against the coal workers. Now, in addition to the coal workers, there are many other examples of clients who simply lack the resources to wage legal battles. It may be domestic violence, divorce, or creditors who are illegally garnishing wages. But in almost every instance, Samantha's clients, even with the law on their side, face an uphill struggle for justice. The author's portrayal of America's legal system is not pretty, and many readers may wonder how our nation can even call what is happening justice. Grisham's contribution to our understanding of the law may be slightly overwrought, but the shortcomings of our legal system that he touches upon here cannot be dismissed. At the end of Gray Mountain, there are many unanswered questions that suggest a sequel. I hope Samantha Cofer comes back for an encore. She is a lawyer to admire and respect. Now, that review was written by Stuart Schiffman in October of this past year, right after the book came out. It's called Gray Mountain by John Grisham. I've read that one myself, and I tell you, it is a good one, and it's available from the North Carolina Library for the Blind. And speaking of popular authors, there were a couple of books by Philip Margolin that were extremely popular in the months of January and February at the North Carolina Library for the Blind. Those were certainly good months in North Carolina to be listening to a book while it's so cold and snowy outside. But let's talk about these two books, a short description of each one. The first one that was really popular was called Heartstone, again by Philip Margolin. They were young, popular, the perfect couple, an all-American boy and a beautiful cheerleader. But the youthful passion that led them to Lookout Point that terrible evening would prove fatal. For Richie Walters, the end came swiftly as death descended upon him in a savage orgy of horrific violence. Elaine Murray would live long enough to learn just how lucky her boyfriend had been. Two brutal slayings have rocked a stunned city. But the murders are merely the nightmare's beginning, flinging open a terrifying Pandora's box of sordid secrets and dark revelations more deadly than the bloodlust that lives in the rock-hard heart of a killer. Again, that's called Heartstone by Philip Margolin. And the next book that was very popular this past month by Margolin was called The Undertaker's Widow. A cold-blooded murder, a beautiful suspect, an honest judge forced to do the unthinkable. New York Times bestselling author Philip Margolin is a master of legal suspense. In this explosive novel, a simple case of self-defense becomes a nightmare in which justice itself is held hostage. Judge Richard Quinn is young, idealistic, and honest to a fault. And that's why he's handed the most sensational homicide case in Oregon history. Locked in a race for the U.S. Senate, Ellen Creese gunned down the intruder who murdered her wealthy husband. In a single brutal instant, she became a widow, a victim, and a hero. Yet, disturbing questions remain. What secrets did the man who started his fortune running mortuaries keep that might have cost him his life? What about the son frozen out of his will, or his wife's political enemies? And what about Ellen Creese herself? Soon it becomes clear that a deadly plot of murder, blackmail, passion, and double cross is unfolding around Judge Richard Quinn. And unless he breaks the rules, justice will not only be blind, it will be the final victim. That is called The Undertaker's Widow. That sounds like a good one, too, taking place in Oregon. Another book by Philip Margolin, one of the most popular authors this past month at the Library for the Blind. Now we're going to take a look at another very, very popular author, and he has written so many books that you can't even count them all. It's called Hope to Die, and it's The Return of Alex Cross by James Patterson. James Patterson didn't get around to introducing Alex Cross, his most popular character to date, until 1993. And since then, Patterson and Cross have become household names. Cross is an interesting character, not so much because of who he is or what he does, as the type of villain he attracts. You can talk about Patterson's strengths and weaknesses as an author, but no one has created as many truly frightening, over-the-top villains as he has. The worst of them all, alas, seem to go after Cross with varying degrees of success before succumbing to failure, sometimes. This book, Hope to Die, is the newly published novel in the Cross canon. It begins immediately after 2013's Cross My Heart. And that worthy book featured Theory Mulch, an adversary as frightening and dangerous as any Cross has ever faced. While other criminals have threatened his family before, none has done so with the effectiveness and cold-blooded intent of Mulch. Cross My Heart chronicled Mulch's success in abducting Cross's entire family, all three generations of it, and taunting him with a photograph that purported to show their dead bodies. Well, Mulch's purpose was twofold. One was to reduce Cross to a ruin of a man. He succeeded in this, but Cross reached down and came back. In Hope to Die, Mulch ups the ante. His goal is to turn Cross into a cold-blooded killer, using the lives of his family as the detective's motivation. Now, he uses a variety of electronic methods and media to communicate with Cross, prodding, goading, and leading him from one part of the country to the next. Cross, though, is not one to be led by the nose. When ordered off the case by the Washington, D.C. police chief, Cross takes off on his own, pursuing a separate investigation while being assisted along the way by a series of unique and occasionally unlikely allies. The storyline proceeds along three narrative tracks: Cross's own first-person narrative, the official investigation, which uncovers some startling information about the man who calls himself Theory Mulch, and Mulch himself, who is both more and much less than what he seems. Cross finds that his reputation as the top detective in the Washington, D.C. Police Department precedes him, as does his unfortunate notoriety as a man whose family has been kidnapped and threatened with murder. He follows a slim evidentiary trail from Maryland to Nebraska, and then from Texas to Louisiana, always a step or two behind his dangerous adversary, as the lives of his family, at least those who remain among the living, hang in the balance. By the time the book reaches its startling conclusion, Cross's life and those of his family members will be changed forever. Hope to Die is full of surprising revelations, twists and turns, as well as heart-stopping suspense and sharp-edged violence. There is something for nearly everyone here. And those who haven't picked up an Alex Cross book for a while, by all means should read Cross My Heart and then this one we just talked about, Hope to Die, both of which demonstrate that Patterson, notwithstanding his prolific ways, retains the ability to surprise, excite, and, well, just plain scare the heck out of you. The book, again, is Hope to Die, The Return of Alec Cross, by very popular author James Patterson. And we have time for just one more. It's called Deadline by John Sanford. In southeast Minnesota, down on the Mississippi, a school board meeting is coming to an end. The board chairman announces that the rest of the meeting will be closed due to personnel issues. Issues is correct. The proposal up for a vote before them is whether to authorize the killing of a local reporter. The vote is 4-1 in favor. Meanwhile, not far away, Virgil Flowers is helping out a friend by looking into a dog napping, which seems to be turning into something much bigger and uglier. A team of dog nappers supplying medical labs when he gets a call from Lucas Davenport. A murdered body has been found, and the victim is a local reporter. It's called Deadline, and it's by the popular author John Sanford, and that was one of the most popular books this past month at the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. And that's about all the time we have for this month's edition of Heard Any Good Books Lately? I'm George Douglas. I hope you enjoyed it. If you would like more information about how to become a patron of the North Carolina Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, simply Google or search for North Carolina Library for the Blind, or you can call toll-free 1-888-388-2460. That's 1-888-388-2460. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Heard Any Good Books Lately will be available right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. I'm George Douglas. Thanks for joining me, and so long until next time.